private money will follow public money. Today, lots of public money goes into oil and gas, so that's where all the money goes. And public, the governments need to reorient their financial and other support for renewable energies for this to happen. If they don't do that, the money will continue to go into oil and gas and nobody will make any progress.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Marie Owens Thompson. Marie is the SVP of Sustainability and Chief Economist at IATA, the industry trade body that works with airlines around the world to ensure not just growth, but sustainable growth now. Marie has led the economics role and is a numbers lady, but of late, she has been also wearing the second hat of heading sustainability. In that role, she works with airlines around the world and guides them on how to make their operations more sustainable. IATA releases forecasts as well as numbers that guide governments, airlines, and other industry partners on how aviation can become more sustainable. This was a very fascinating chat, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Mary, it's great to be speaking with you. You were previously the chief economist at IATA. I've heard you many times, and you were the numbers lady. Now you've got a sustainability hat that you're wearing as well. Tell me about this transition, and what is your vision for both of these roles?
Yes, so we have engineered a proper merger of these two activities, and the division is now called Sustainability and Economics. And of course, this greatly facilitates everybody's task because the things are so interconnected. And, you know, in an ideal world, and I don't quite know how that could actually occur, but in an ideal world, we would love to have a systemic response in the world as a whole to this systemic crisis that is climate change. Right. And this is just one baby step, you know, towards thinking a bit more systemically and holistically about these issues. So if I may go on yet a little bit more on this topic, we usually interact, of course, within our aviation community on the issues that pertain to air transportation's transition to net zero. So that's great. We talk to all the other people in our value chain, aircraft manufacturers, and ICAO, of course, our UN body for civil aviation and so on. But it's very hard to get this conversation to extend beyond aviation and beyond the aviation value chain and include also the energy producers and the policymakers and the energy ministries and the treasuries and all the banks and everybody who all together are necessary for bringing this to fruition. So all of that just to give you a little bit of context on how marginal this little merger is between sustainability and economics, but it's a start.
You know what? I would actually flip that. I think this merger between economics and sustainability is huge because traditionally, IATA's role is to safeguard the aviation industry's interests, and that often has meant growth. Growth is, of course, what economics has been about. Yet, there is increasing sustainability pressure. I think there's willingness on the industry's part, but there are challenges that lie ahead. The biggest of which is how do you balance growth with sustainability? And in this merger, I see hope that, oh, economics and sustainability, growth and sustainability. And I'd love to hear, how do you advise airlines and the industry that's looking to grow to also balance and achieve sustainability goals?
Yes. I mean, first, I think everybody needs to understand that this is a completely an airline's self-interest. Yeah. You know, fuel has always been the highest cost component in airlines' costs composition. And ever since 1944, when civil aviation was created, airlines have been progressively together, of course, with the aircraft manufacturers and so on, working very hard on reducing our energy consumption because that way our costs go down. Yeah. So it's hard for me to understand that anybody doubts our sincerity when we really want to engineer this transition and consume less fuel. That would be clearly my number one. And the other thing that your comments make me think of is, of course, you know, if we think of the 20th, now I'm speaking a bit as the economist, yeah? So let's think about the 20th century. Yeah, that was an amazing century from, you know, never before have we pulled so many people out of poverty and had such an equal income distribution across the globe. And it was just an amazing century. And many things happened, of course. But two of the salient features for that success was all the innovation in transportation and how that innovation in transportation brought transportation costs down, which allowed, you know, ideas and goods and people and everything to flow much more efficiently around the globe. And that was a real driver of economic development. And the other big driver of economic development was, of course, our expanded use of fossil fuel. So during that century, we put fossil fuel into absolutely everything we do. Yeah. and now we have understood that that part of the economic model has come to its absolute limit. And we now have to wean ourselves off of fossil fuel. And the good news is that for that, we have alternative solutions. We do know how to produce renewable energy, right? So that's amazing. If we look at the aviation side, we do not have any alternative to airplanes. So it's an absolutely indispensable and necessary part of any economic development plan. So ergo, here we are. The main challenge is to produce as much sustainable and renewable energy as possible for the whole world, and then to make sure that we produce our little share or that we can benefit in the total production of what we need to be able to fly airplanes sustainably. And then maybe the next century can even be the 20th century. That's certainly my hope.
Very interesting perspective. Now, to fly airplanes sustainably, which is what you just mentioned, the reality is that most of the airplanes being produced for the next few decades will be using today's technology. So it's not necessarily electric or hydrogen. And that's where sustainable aviation fuel becomes absolutely critical. IATA's 100%. Latest estimates, exactly. IATA's latest estimates show that in 2024, SAF production will triple to 1.8 billion liters, which is fantastic. But this is only 0.53% of aviation's fuel need.
Mm.
Do you see this as a bit of a challenge? How do we bridge this gap?
Oh, this is a huge challenge, obviously. Yeah. So in roughly speaking, you know, between now and 2050, we need to increase production 1,000-fold. 1,000 times greater production will be needed in 2050 compared to today. So that is obviously a very challenging situation. But indeed, as you say, as long as we don't have any alternative modes of propulsion, you know, with which to drive aircraft forward, we are sort of stuck with the combustion engine, right? So we're different from cars in that sense. Cars, we can replace the combustion engine and drive electric, but this is not really possible at scale and at the distances and with the number of people that we transport in airplanes yet, at least. So for the foreseeable future, we will still be using combustion engines, and therefore we will have to burn some kind of fuel in our engines. But with sustainable aviation fuels, we can they can be done 100% from non-fossil fuel sources, right? So we can completely make this fuel without oil. And that's obviously where we get this decarbonization gain, yeah, is in the production of the fuel, even if we will still combust the energy and have a certain amount of emissions. So the beauty of it is that this can be done. We don't have to retrofit any aircraft. We don't have to build any new infrastructure. So this is why we call these sustainable aviation fuels, we call them drop-in fuels, yeah? Because you just drop it in the ordinary fuel and make a mix of these two, yeah? So there's, you could obviously blend more, blend less. At the moment, the authorities are only allowing up to a 50-50% blend. At some point in the future, we will be able to fly 100% on sustainable aviation fuel. And therefore, this is really the main avenue towards our industry's decarbonization, certainly until we get other forms of propulsion commercially viable.
Right. Thank you so much for that insightful reply. Now, the demand for SAF is not the issue. Every single drop of SAF that was produced in 2023 was used and flown. The challenge is, you mentioned, SAF capacity has to grow 1,000-fold to meet the airline industry's demand. There's a dramatic shortfall. Where is this going to come from, and what's needed for us to get there?
Yes. I mean, I would actually love it, you know, if we could manage to do all of this without the big oil companies, and grow a whole new industry, obviously with alternative energy producers and in particular then sustainable aviation fuel producers. That would be amazing. But given the quantities that we will be requiring, and given the infrastructure that is owned by the big oil and gas companies that we sort of need, you know, it's hard to imagine succeeding without them. And that's problematic today, because today it's just too easy to make tons of money in the oil and gas sector. And of course, since the war broke out in Ukraine, all the restrictions that had started to be put on development of oil and gas have been lifted. And now it's like another bonanza for oil and gas, and everybody's drilling like mad. And the International Energy Agency is projecting that there will be an increase of 6% in oil wells this year. And that is twice the rate of global GDP. So that would be like planning for a world where we were going to need twice as much oil. Whereas in actual fact, obviously, with the Paris Agreement and everything, all these countries have said that we're going to use less. So there's an amazing eye-watering incoherence sort of between what's actually happening and what people are saying that they want to do. And that's obviously not easy to fix, because we have to make it less attractive to invest in oil and gas, and more attractive to invest in renewable energies. And here I would say, you know, that private money will follow public money. Today, lots of public money goes into oil and gas, so that's where all the money goes. And public, the governments need to reorient their financial and other support for renewable energies for this to happen. If they don't do that, the money will continue to go into oil and gas, and nobody will make any progress.
Right. It's so interesting you mentioned the record profits of the oil companies in the last couple of years. The interesting thing I learned from Akshat Rathi from Bloomberg Green was, even though the actual amount of investment from these oil majors into renewables has increased over time, the percentage of total revenues that are being invested in renewables has remained the same since the 1990s. So even though the percentage of, you know, the profits have doubled, for example, essentially the investment in renewables has halved, yes, if you look at it, because yes, it's not absolutely being proportional, yes, which is the alarming part.
Yeah, so obviously it depends on whose investments you're talking about. Yeah, so if we're talking about government support for oil and gas production, that has gone up every year. Yeah, every year, all the governments in the world support oil and gas with, you know, production subsidies that increase every year, have continued to increase every year ever since the Paris Agreement in 2015. Yeah, so that is obviously problematic. And then we can also look at, you know, the oil and gas companies themselves and how they spend their money, indeed. And when you do that, you see that they only spend 3% of their money on renewable investments, yeah. And, you know, whatever, round number, 45% they obviously spend on their own industry. And then they spend, you know, some other round number, 45% on share buybacks and dividend payouts. So, you know, those are...
It's a very profiteering business from, you know, I know we went off on a tangent away from aviation, but it makes me cringe a little.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's... This has to stop. And I insist again on the idea that, you know, private money follows public money. I spent most of my career in banking, and of course these past few decades when we struggled with sort of very low inflation and we had negative interest rates in lots of places and so on, you know, the central banks were buying bonds, right? And the saying in the financial markets was, you know, follow the central banks, and that's what everybody did. Yeah, so it's totally the way it works. If you see that the government is investing in something,
right,
that's a very, very strong signal that you should do the same. So right. We need to see the governments investing in renewables, which they did with wind and solar. So mm-hmm. You know, it's a little bit of a question, mystifying me at least, why they seem reluctant to do so when it comes to sustainable aviation fuels.
Yeah. Still sticking on sustainable aviation fuels, I know that the proportion of SAF as compared to all renewable fuel production has grown from 3% in 2023 to 6% in 2024. But aviation really needs between 25 and 30% of global renewable fuel production capacity for SAF. The pushback, though, from many quarters is this is unfair. Other industries need these resources as well, especially if it's green e-fuel and PTL. How do you justify aviation's want of these limited renewable fuel resources?
Well, yeah, of course, it depends then on, you know, from which point in time you're looking at this thing. So, you know, I think my first reaction to what you just said is that obviously we're not producing enough renewable fuel. Yeah. So it sort of comes back to what we were discussing previously. So objective number one, you know, should be for the whole world and all the industries, every country, everywhere, to really focus their minds on their transition away from fossil fuels and towards making more renewable fuel. And if we imagine, you know, such a thing taking place, then I don't see any reason why we would in the future consume any more of the refining output than we are consuming of current refining output. Yeah. So in using from the oil sector. So in a traditional refinery, we add up all of that capacity and our industry consumes about 8% of that output. Yeah. And in the future, I would assume that we will come to a point where we will be consuming about 8% of renewable refined output. And okay, progressively, even further into the future, our share might grow depending on how the other industries electrify, and therefore might not use so much of these types of renewable refined products, yeah. But as they haven't done so yet, I think there will be a time when our share of the total should be in the vicinity of 8%. So that's a bit problematic actually for us, referring back to our earlier conversation too, because we're sort of not big enough, yeah, for anybody to really care. And the oil companies, they can totally do their profit maximization without us. If we disappeared, it wouldn't really hurt their top line very much. So that's a problem, you know, and that's where, you know, obviously heating homes and fuel for cars and all of these things that everybody uses, you know, takes precedence. And that's where we might feel a little bit threatened in terms of our ability to defend our needs in this domain.
This is a very interesting concept that you bring up, Mary, which is the point around significance, the significance of the industry. Aviation is about a $1 trillion industry, I believe, globally on an annual basis. Yet you're saying it may not be significant enough for the oil majors to look at us seriously. Yet for people who travel, people who have experienced the magic of flying, it is the single most, you know, magical thing they might have done or significant thing that they might have done. How do we ensure that going forward in the next few decades, aviation keeps its place in the global pecking order and has access to these resources, especially as people push back and say, oh, guess what? Very few people fly, and hence you should not have access to so many resources. It should be proportional. But we know that aviation has an outsized impact in the economies and in the lives of people who do travel. How do we ensure that?
Yes, it's totally, again, this same thing. Yeah, that I think that the two magic potion ingredients in economic development are transportation and preferably cheap transportation, and the other one is access to energy. Yeah, if you have energy and transportation, you will be rich. Yeah, that's how it is for countries. And if you look at the poor countries around the world, most of them are located in Central Africa, and they don't have transportation and they don't have energy. So there's clearly a win-win thing happening here, yeah, from an economic development perspective, that if a country manages to increase its production of renewable energy and secure a bit of energy independence from that, that will be hugely positive for their economic development. And if some of that can be used to improve their transportation network, then you have a double whammy benefit from that investment. So I think really countries need to look at this from that perspective. How are we going to ensure economic development in our country? And if they really do look at that, then they cannot avoid, I would argue, understanding the importance of these two things, transportation and energy. And if we can, you know, I'm 100% for every form of transportation, and they should all be cheap and sustainable. But obviously, aviation is unique, right? Because there's no way of flying without airplanes. So, and there's, you know, obviously continents that are vast where no other form of transportation makes sense. And when we want to fly between continents, move between continents, again, we see obviously the indispensable nature of aviation and island communities. I mean, we have island communities obviously in Europe as well, yeah? So this is the indispensable nature of aviation and the necessity to develop transportation and energy production for economic development. If everybody focuses on that, then, you know, the beauty with humanity is that then we can do incredible things together. It's when we haven't quite made up our minds, yeah, that these things are necessary and we're still dithering. This is where, you know, collectively we fail to move forward. And I think a lot of the dithering is political, yeah, not necessarily really looking at economic development and what's really important and how should we prioritize. You know, if you're prioritizing your vote count maybe in your next election, well, that is obviously when you can understand how people would say that it's not necessarily important to fly. Right.
It's interesting you mention intent. Like with everything in life, when we have a strong, clear intent, things start to happen. So one of the things I'm impressed by is that
aviation as an industry has shown clear intent to address its emissions. For example, the recently concluded CAF 3 concluded that, you know, international aviation will be 5% less carbon intensive by 2030, not 2050, not 2040, by 2030. How do you think we'll get there? Will that just be through SAF, or will that be through other aspects? Are there other pathways that exist to get there as well?
Yes, I think this agreement is really important because obviously it was a declaration formulated by the member states of ICAO, which is, again, the International Civil Aviation Organization, which is an agency under the UN system. So it's fantastic to be so aligned with the member states. That's how we feel in our industry and as representatives of our 321 member airlines. So that's great. We're committed. ICAO is committed. And how will it happen? Well, it literally, again, comes back to the key question about how can we make the investment proposition an appealing one to those who might open a SAF production plant. And indeed, my answer to that part of your question too, as to whether this will be primarily SAF, yes, it will be primarily SAF. But we obviously do need to have to advance on all fronts as one, simultaneously, because if we try to do it in a sequenced fashion, the other solutions will mature too late. And right. And there's something that this declaration acknowledged, which I think is really vital here, another necessary piece of market infrastructure for all of this to succeed, which is some kind of registry, or often it's referred to as a SAF accounting system, that needs to be created. And the declaration, nods to how important this could be and sets out some principles for how that should occur. And what we can do with this type of system is ensure two things. Yeah. And first of all, ensure that all countries in the world could participate in SAF production and sell their output on a global SAF market. So that's really important, yeah, that we don't have little localized SAF markets that don't speak to each other. Yeah, so we want a global, liquid, and mature SAF market, and we need this type of registry for that. And we also want all airlines in the world to be able to have access to SAF purchases, even if maybe at that point in time their country is not producing. Yeah. So we don't want to exclude airlines from the market just by the fact that they happen to be located in a place with no SAF. And we also finally want the airlines to be able to claim their SAF purchases against their decarbonization obligations. So if they can't purchase, they obviously can't fulfill their obligations, and that's problematic.
That's very interesting that you mentioned this. So jet fuel today is global and globally tradable, and airlines can choose where to buy, where's the cheapest one, and that's how it's done. But SAF production is very localized. In fact, 90% of SAF today is in California. So someone like a Kenya Airways or Qantas doesn't necessarily have as much access to SAF locally as, let's say, Alaska Airlines or United does. IATA currently plays a strong role in ensuring that aviation is global with its clearinghouse, for example. How can you play a strong role in implementing some of these frameworks around SAF that you spoke about, or are these just guidelines for someone else to implement?
No, I think we are totally poised to see if we can be the ones who set up and operate this registry and SAF accounting system. And the reason why we would like to do this is very much exactly like you said, our clearinghouse, where we actually make sure that the money that comes, that somebody pays for a ticket, that all the slices of that money goes to the right people, so that the tax authorities, the travel agents, and whatever number of airlines that might be involved in the ticket, all of that gets done by IATA at a cost cover basis. So, a couple of cents at the most per transaction, and that obviously helps our industry by minimizing their costs. So we managed to do that. We managed to process 300 billion every year and not lose airlines money. So we sort of feel emboldened by that fact and think that we should be able to manage the certificates that come with these SAF purchases and manage that they are treated in a safe and orderly fashion then used to fulfill, again, these decarbonization obligations that airlines will have under CORSIA, they have under the European system, and maybe there will be others in the future. So that's our intent, is to potentially do this. And the interest is to minimize the cost for airlines, because the SAF production today, for sure, you know, it comes at a price that is much more expensive than jet fuel. So in this way, we could also contribute to minimizing the cost impact of the transition for our industry. Whereas there are people out there who obviously also want to do this, yeah, and who would love to charge lots of money for that, yeah.
Right. So you mentioned the price differential between SAF and jet fuel today. That is the green premium. Who pays for this green premium?
Yes, I mean, you know, historically, if you look at, so again, you know, fuel has always been the highest cost component for airlines, right? And therefore, obviously, airlines have always tried to push it down. But, you know, how much of the fuel costs have airlines been able to pass on to customers? I guess that's your question a bit, yeah? Yeah, exactly. So when we look at that historically, we see that airlines have pretty much use the two options that are available to them. Yeah, either take the costs onto their profit margins and absorb them themselves, resulting in lower profit margins, or indeed they try to pass these costs onto the passengers. And historically, again, airlines have used both of these levers. Now, you know, which one they will use at any particular time obviously depends on the market context. Yeah. So, you know, the first requirement of any business is to cover your costs. Yeah. So if you can't cover your costs, you're going to go bankrupt. So it's totally normal that airlines want to cover their costs. And then, you know, to take it on, that means that to take it on your margins means that you have to have some kind of positive margin in the first place. Otherwise, obviously, you can't do that. So we all know that, you know, historically here too, airlines have never been, you know, supremely profitable. Yeah, we're talking about net profit margins in single digits. Currently, we're thinking, you know, around 2.5% net profit margin. Whereas, you know, banks and oil companies, you know, they approach the 30% net profit margins. Yeah, so we're not really in the same universe.
The interesting thing is, you're right about profit margins. The challenge is, if airlines pass these costs to passengers, that results in a reduction of demand. And demand management is something airlines are not in favor of. Going back to our earlier starting question around balancing growth with sustainability. If demand management is not on the cards, typically I've not seen that in the IATA net zero roadmaps. How do we get there? And what do you say to critics who say, oh, we must have demand management and we just cannot keep growing the way aviation has been growing in the past?
Well, I say again, if you know, there's no way we can prevent countries from implementing bad economic policies. Yeah, this has happened many times and still happens on a daily basis in lots of places. And you know, I don't know, in Europe, for instance, I happen to think that the UK's decision to leave the EU, for instance, is one stellar example of a country that should have known better, and has then resulted in self-imposed pain. Yeah. So if that's the way that countries want to go, then for sure they can go ahead and limit transportation. Yeah. And then they will have inferior economic outcomes. And I am restating again, you know, the two necessary ingredients for economic development is access to energy and transportation. Yeah, transportation has always been what has driven economic development in all our humanity. You know, first it was camels, right? Or first it was walking, and you know, and then we could use animals to move around, and then boats. And at every time that humanity has discovered a new way of moving around, we see a really big shift up in economic development in our economic history. And again, the counterexample is, of course, that the countries that are the most poor in our world economy today are the countries that lack this, that have much less transportation and connectivity with the rest of the world, and arguably also lower access to energy. So, you know, the degrowth idea is that, yeah, it's a conscious choice to not increase your economic welfare for your population. Yeah. It's amazing if that can be a vote winner.
It's interesting, and especially with the experiments we've seen in the Netherlands and the back and forth of late, we'll see how all of this pans out. One of the things I do want to touch upon is the pathways to SAF. Currently, most of the SAF will continue coming from feedstock, waste oil-based things, but there are certain jurisdictions like the refuel in EU which require, going forward in the future, PTL and e-fuels being clear pathways, whereas other countries like the US don't. What's better, and how can IATA guide governments and countries in what's the best pathway to get SAF?
Well, I think, you know, there's indeed multiple solutions for making sustainable aviation fuel, and today there's only one that's commercially mature, which is the HEFAP pathway that uses, you know, used cooking oil and other sources of fatty waste. Yeah, so we need these other production techniques, if you wish. Yeah, which is what we tend to call pathways. We need the other pathways to be approved and enter into, you know, reach the point of commercial viability. And there are many different forms of waste that can be used in these other not yet mature pathways. Yeah. So we can use waste from the wood industry. We can use, you know, household waste, human waste, you know, and there are so many of these various waste inputs that can be used for sustainable aviation fuel. And in terms of order of priorities, we should probably try to prioritize the production processes that use that can accept the broadest spread, you know, the selection of different forms of input, compared to a production process maybe that can just use one. So this is sort of the criticism against HEFA. Yeah. And indeed, one can totally imagine that over time in the SAF mix, HEFA might, you know, wane in its share of total SAF production, and these other pathways might become more important. But that should not be confused with the idea that HEFA disappears. Yeah. So it can maintain a constant, maybe, rate of output, and be a valid industry, even if its share in the total diminishes when the others come on.
Right. Okay, that does make sense. You mentioned earlier that IATA is now proactively working with multiple parties, not just the aviation industry, but looking beyond. What have been some of the big successes you've had in working with governments or banks or people outside the aviation industry? Are there a couple of instances that come to mind?
Well, I think, so of course my brain goes first of all to this CAF conference, because that was a recent experience, but it doesn't really address your question because that was obviously an in aviation sector event. But if I nevertheless can start there, I was still happy, you know, to see how the governments lent us their ears. And how our inputs, I feel, were given proper attention and are reflected in the final declaration that was adopted. So first of all, having that you know, constructive dialogue with the governments is obviously key. And now, you know, in terms of big successes in interacting with people outside of the aviation sector, I think we're more like in the embryonic stages of that happening. You know, for now, we're just really focusing on trying to make baby steps in terms of providing these pieces of essential market infrastructure so that we can work towards promoting this global and mature SAF market that we really need. And that involves, for instance, developing model procurement contracts so that the airlines have a template to follow when they go and negotiate with the SAF producers. And it includes, you know, looking at this registry, the SAF accounting framework, and it includes, you know, putting people together and in very, very many specific discussions that we have around all kinds of solutions that are going to be important in our transition, including non-CO2 solutions. And, you know, the list is long, but I can't really brag about, you know, a huge win yet.
Right. No, I'm glad that you're taking this. Yeah, I'm glad you're taking the first steps. And that is what is encouraging, that the vision is beyond thinking beyond aviation and the traditional mandate of IATA. What do you say to critics who say, despite everything, IATA and the industry are not doing enough? And they often use the CORSIA framework as an example, like, look, you know, it's such low targets. It's not really going far enough. What do you say to them?
Well, show me an industry that does more. Yeah. You know, that I think is the first one. So the industry was obviously extremely advanced when it adopted, you know, thanks to the member states and our UN organization, ICAO, the brainchild of CORSIA dates from 2016. Yeah. So that's immediately after the Paris Agreement that, that our member states involved in aviation decided that here's a solution for international aviation, a first step towards its decarbonization. That was a very early move. I haven't seen any such moves from any other industry. So, you know, that really needs to, that member states need to be applauded for that. And then people might not understand really CORSIA or think that offsets are important. But, you know, that is just not really understanding the magnitude of the challenge here and the fact that we don't have solutions, you know. So obviously the atmosphere doesn't care where emissions are being cut. Yeah. So if we don't have a solution for cutting emissions in aviation, surely it's better that aviation pays money to cutting them elsewhere. Yeah, that has to be the case. And okay, if people criticize, you know, the offsets for you know, lack of control or oversight or quality or whatever, then we need to make that better. Yeah, you know, this is not unfortunately my own quote, but somebody said it's not because we have tax fraud that we scrap the taxation system, right? So, you know, it's not the fault of the solution that it was, you know, perhaps on occasion not super well managed. Yeah, so we just have to learn how to do this better. Plus the fact that under CORSIA, you can claim your SAF purchases, right? So if we don't like the other form of offsets, you know, if we can claim SAF purchases under CORSIA, then that's obviously, I'm assuming nobody has any problem with that. So if we look at the money that the industry has committed under CORSIA, which runs until 2035, we think that our industry will pay between 20 and 30 billion under CORSIA. Wow. And now we're quickly moving up to a couple of billion next year for extra cost for SAF. Yeah. So again, I'd love to see anybody who can find an industry who has committed more funds and is more dedicated to its transition than aviation, actually.
That is encouraging, given that becoming sustainable is a global issue. What would your advice be as formerly lead, you know, being the chief economist and now also having the sustainability portfolio within you? What would you advise airlines who are trying to balance growth with sustainability commitments?
Well, I mean, I think I will answer that in a slightly broader way than just the sustainability concerns, you know. So let's all remember that it was only in 2020 that airlines collectively lost $140 billion because of the pandemic. Yeah. So basically, of course, I hope we all remember that air traffic almost entirely ceased. Yeah, there was basically no flying. And from that complete halt, you know, it has now managed to crawl back to profitability this year. So we're looking at about $24 billion profit for the industry this year. So that's a phenomenal change, you know, big gap to have filled, and to fill that gap in only 3 years is amazing. But then we obviously understand that the balance sheets are still impaired. Yeah. So how do you build the balance sheet if, you know, if year after year you're not making any profit and after such a tremendous loss? So even if airlines have been paying back most of the state aid that they received during the pandemic, they are still more indebted today than they were before the pandemic. And you know, to be able to think creatively about the future and invest and do new things and do things better, you need a solid balance sheet. Yeah. So I think, you know, the rebound in profitability proves how amazingly resilient airlines are. But the sort of relative weakness on the balance sheet side shows that airlines, the sector, still has a problem with robustness. Yeah. So if we were rich, yeah, if our industry had the balance sheets to be able to do things like, you know, future-proof themselves, I would love to see airlines insourcing their fuel supply. If airlines somehow, that would be a big ask, yeah, because airlines just fly people around. They don't, you know, make energy. But right, let's just fantasize that they could make energy, you know, or buy their way into that sector. If airlines could insource their fuel supply and their fuel of their sustainable aviation fuel, obviously, then they could control those costs and insource some of those profits that are currently paid by the airlines to the oil and gas sector. And that would be world for aviation.
That is a very interesting idea, because I think it has been tried in the past when it comes to vertical integration, when Delta, for example, bought a refinery years ago in Texas. And I think we are seeing more of this when it comes to sustainability, where you have airlines like United investing in SAF companies, or American Airlines recently invested in Infinium, an e-fuels company. You also have the likes of SAS Scandinavian or Air Canada investing in Heart Aerospace, which is electric aircraft. I think when it comes to sustainable technologies for the future, airlines are doing a much better job of vertical integration, which is, I think, what you're referring
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, that's what gives me hope. What gives you hope for the future of sustainable aviation, given the hats you're wearing and the global overview that you have, Mary?
Yes, I think, you know, this is really what needs to be done, sort of a greater examination of alternative revenue streams. Yeah, that, you know, so somehow I feel, you know, I've only been in this industry 2 years. Yeah, so I allow myself nevertheless to make these observations with all due respect to all the airlines, of course. But, you know, sometimes I look at this industry and feel like they've outsourced all the big revenue earners and kept the ones that don't really make that much money. So I think at a broader reflection about how one could diversify the revenue stream, that it is also something that is necessary to build greater robustness for the future. And the other issues are obviously more to do with the structure of the value chain, that upstream we have all of these monopolies and oligopolies with outsized pricing power. And then, downstream, we have this ultra-competitive environment where every passenger in the world can see all the prices simultaneously. You know, that just doesn't happen in any other industry either. I come from finance, and of course, we have, complete price transparency there, but it's B2B. It would never occur to any of those banks to show those prices to the clients, you know? So this is a difficult thing to resolve, because building airplanes is difficult. So we won't necessarily have much more competition there. And airlines, airports are sort of natural monopolies. Yeah. So I think really the answer ultimately comes back to what we've already said several times, but I'll say it again, that governments, countries need to understand that transportation and energy are the two main drivers of economic development. And if we get everybody working in that direction, then I think that we can create an air transport industry that is resilient and robust. And that's obviously in the interest of everybody who participates in the value chain and beyond.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Marie, for going deep into these questions. Now, the final part of this interview is a bit more fun. I call this the rapid fire round, in which I will ask you simple questions and you have to give me one line answers. So we'll start with a simple one. What's your favorite movie?
That's an interesting one. Maybe 1900, Bertolucci. Does anybody remember that?
I'm going to Google it and check it out. What about your favorite book?
I like the Russian authors, so I would say Lolita or The Master and Margarita. That's okay. Nabokov and Bulgakov, respectively, I believe.
Okay, thank you. Lolita is indeed a classic. What's your favorite airline?
I love all our airline members equally.
All right, how about this? What was your favorite airline up until you joined IATA a few years ago?
Well, I think obviously we do tend to get attached to national flag carriers, right? And I did grow up in Sweden, and I let you guys figure out the rest.
All right. Okay. Well, you must be very happy they've ordered some electric airplanes then.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. What's your favorite city?
Well, now I live in Geneva, so that's obviously, I feel, a very great privilege to be able to live in Geneva. Okay. So I'll say Geneva.
Sure. What is something that you would like to learn?
Kite surfing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Have you tried that before?
Never.
Okay. I would highly recommend either Florianopolis in Brazil or Zanzibar, which is where I learned it. Both have very nice sheltered coves for you to learn and, spend the entire day without fearing the waves. Or if you want to learn it closer to Europe or in Europe, there's a beach off the north coast of Denmark where you have to wear a wetsuit and you can still learn it.
Right, yeah. I hear that the origin of kitesurfing is in Switzerland, though.
Really?
Yeah, the lake of Silvaplana near St. Moritz.
Well, then you just have to drive or take a train.
Exactly. I've logged all your suggestions, though. I would love to do that. Thanks for the handy tips.
Sure. What is the best advice you've received, Mary?
I think, follow your gut. Follow your gut. Stay true to your convictions. Do your own thing.
Okay. Okay. Do you think you've been following your gut, which led you to IATA?
Yes. Of course, with a lot of luck on top of it, yeah. And and I give all the credit, of course, to our inspired leadership and Willie Walsh, who had the courage and still has the courage to hire women into senior positions.
No,
men
that's
need to hire
fantastic.
Women. Problem solved.
Absolutely. And governments need to focus on energy and transport. I think we have three world problem solved, three big ones
Absolutely.
Solved right here in this interview.
Absolutely.
What do you do in your free time, Mary?
Well, I like running, I like skiing, and I also like to ride horses.
Wow, you're in the perfect city then, being in Geneva.
Absolutely.
Probably can do all three of those.
Absolutely.
If you were on a really long haul flight, let's say 18 hours, who would you like to sit next to?
Oh, any one of my sons or all three of them?
Oh, fantastic. All right, you've got the whole row to yourself then.
Exactly.
Okay. If, final question, if we speak 1 year from now and we are popping champagne, what are we celebrating?
I think we must be celebrating another record increase in SAF production in the world.
I am glad that you put record increase in SAF production ahead of your other hat of record increase in flying. So congratulations on that. I really enjoyed this conversation, Marie. Thank you so much.
Me too. Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation and hope to see you again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplyflying, that's simply with an i.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplyflying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simply Flying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our Supervising Editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.